Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that sin. It's gonna get you some.
Hey everybody, welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm your host, Souther Teague, and we're broadcasting live from the future today.
I love the future. It's nice here.
Yeah, right? Jetpacks and rocket shoes and all that stuff. Because Damon and I are down in New Orleans at Tales of the Cocktail right now.
So, and I'm sure you're having a great time.
We're going to predict that right now. I'm going to say it's a winner.
Yeah.
So in the studio today, I'm here with Harry from, I forgot the name of your show.
Feast Your Ears.
Feast Your Ears. Harry has a show right here on the Heritage Radio Network called Feast Your Ears.
I do. Hopefully, if you listen to Feast Your Ears, you just ride on through to the speakeasy.
That's right.
The speakeasy
right before
after
us.
My show.
Yeah, right before us. But that's not why I have you on the air today.
No.
Even though that's plenty of reason.
Sure.
I got you on the air today because you're an interesting character in the food and beverage scene here in New York City.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And I want to kind of, generally speaking here on the show, we kind of back up a little bit and talk about what you've been up to for the first segment, and then we kind of take a break, and we'll talk about what you're into these days, which we'll talk about
cool.
a lot.
Great.
Right? So say who you are, where you're from, what you're doing.
So I'm Harry Rosenblum. When people ask me where I'm from, I say I grew up in Westchester, because being in New York City, Westchester's like this place. It's like a cloud, like a vague place to the north that you can either get to through many traffic-filled roads or perhaps on Metro North on the train. Hard to get there by bicycle or by foot. I grew up there, but lived in Northern California as a teenager. I feel like that was fairly formative for me. And then went to college in Massachusetts and moved to Williamsburg, kind of by accident, 18 years ago last week.
Oh, wow.
I had a friend in...
So you've seen a pretty major change in that little part of Brooklyn.
Yeah, definitely. And the city as a whole, too.
Of course.
And I have vague memories of the city as a kid. I mean, I have one memory of being very young, riding in the jump seat of a Checker taxi. But those were kind of gone when I was really little. And I remember the subways being covered in graffiti from a couple of trips into the city. But I didn't, like, ride them every day or anything.
Right.
But yeah, been a lot of changes in Williamsburg in that time. But now I've done a lot of things in my life. I've been a plumber, an electrician, a scenic designer, a lighting designer for television and theater, and had a cabinet shop for a while and a lot of different things.
Man of many parts.
Yeah. And now my wife Taylor and I own the Brooklyn Kitchen.
Love
which
that
is
place.
A cooking school. We have two studios, one in Williamsburg and one in Sunset Park. That we just opened.
I haven't visited the Sunset Park spot yet, but I've taught a few classes at the
and you actually taught, I think, at the OG in our original little store space on
I did
Dormer Street.
Yeah, that's a long time ago.
Yeah,
right.
So we opened the Brooklyn Kitchen in 2006, and I think met Souther. I think I met you shortly thereafter.
Yep.
So that's what we've been doing. Running classes, we've sort of shifted our focus from being a store that also had cooking classes and also had a grocery and a butcher shop and a fish counter and those sort of things. We've closed the retail operation of our company, and we are focusing.
That's recent, right?
That's recent. The past month or two,
mm-hmm.
And we are focusing on teaching people how to cook. Our new sort of slogan is that we will teach you how to cook like a grown ass adult.
Yeah. Which is important. I think, we talk pretty regularly, and it seems that, especially in a metropolitan area like New York City, but I'm sure it's true of all major cities, the kitchen is such a fucking afterthought in your home, your apartment, that it doesn't encourage you to want to be in that room and cook. You know, I mentioned to you, I think, yesterday that my kitchen is way smaller than the studio that we're in, which is tiny. And I have lived there almost 2 years, and I have 100% absolutely never cooked there. That's crazy.
I mean, and then you go out into, like, the suburbs, I feel like, and, you know, the kitchens are enormous. And
bigger
then,
than my apartment.
And then I feel like in, like, the 80s, you know, people started to eat, like, then you have the eat-in kitchens. So you have kitchens that have, like, a bar that have a bunch of stools, and then you have kitchens that don't really have any walls that kind of, like, bleed into the living room. So now I feel like you, you know, in the sort of more modern housing outside of New York, I feel like you could be standing at the stove, and you could have people sitting on a couch watching TV. Because, like, the living room and the kitchen and the dining room are kind of all blended together.
Yeah, those open space areas.
Yeah.
So, and one of your other slogans is painted real big on the side of the wall there, and also you have bumper stickers, eat real food.
Yeah.
What do you mean when you say that?
So, for me...
And this show's usually about drinking. We're going to talk about some food first, but we're going to get to drinking.
I think you should...
Hang on, listeners. We're going to get to drinking.
I mean, I would say you should drink real drinks, too.
I mean,
right?
I'm drinking right now.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. So, you know, the eat real food slogan was born just out of this idea that, you know, the food space is full of lots of discussion about where you should get your food and who should produce your food and what's the right food to have. And people have lots of opinions about that stuff. And it's not – I've always taken a kind of libertarian view of that, that it's like it's – you know, I'm not going to proselytize to you to tell you what's right for you, but I think we can all agree that we should be eating real food. It's I find it very hard for someone to walk up and be like, no man, this Twinkie, look at how many ingredients are in this. This is totally, you should eat this.
Yeah.
This is normal, right?
Right.
Like, you know, I think we can all agree that, like, yeah, is that an egg on a piece of bread? That's real, right? That's real food. And then what you that to mean yourself.
What was it? Michael Pollan said, if you see an ingredients list that has anything listed that wouldn't be present in your grandmother's kitchen, don't buy it.
Or that you can't pronounce, or that you don't know what it is.
Yeah. If you can't make that yourself, then don't buy it.
Yeah. So for me, that's what real food is about. And whether that means, you know, baking your own bread for you, if you're, like, into that, or milling your own flour, I mean, that's, you know, sure.
It's a bridge,
like,
too far, buddy.
Or if what that means is, like, oh, I'm going to eat an apple, like, that's real food, right? So
absolutely. I totally get that. And you're trying to spearhead a movement and teach people how to not only eat real food, but to shop for it and then take it home and cook it themselves.
Yeah, because I think that we, you know, increasingly, I mean, you know, you see it. I mean, I had this moment the other day where I, like, remembered riding on the train when I first moved to New York 18 years ago. I carried a CD player, a CD Walkman.
Yeah.
And I carried a sleeve in my backpack of, like, six CDs and a CD wallet so I could decide what I wanted to listen to. And I carried a book, or I carried the newspaper.
Right.
And, like, that, because I had a long commute back then. I commuted, like, an hour each way on the subway.
Right.
So that's what I carried. And now everybody's sitting there and everybody's looking at their phone. Right. And and I just, like, had this memory about that. And I feel like, you know, back then, sure, you have headphones on, you're not really interacting with people, but at least you're, like, looking around.
Yeah.
Right. And you could, like, see, make eye contact with somebody. And we're starting, you know, more things. And not that technology is bad, right? I don't want to be like the Luddite. Like, technology is great. There's a lot of amazing things about
Everybody
it.
Knows I'm kind of a Luddite. My only computing device is my phone. I've said it 100 times on this show.
And you manage to lead a normal life in the modern age.
I guess.
I mean,
I do all right.
You communicate with people.
I'm doing all right.
You're drinking a beer right now. I mean, come on. But I think that one of the things about the if you go deeper into what we try to teach people about is commensality and being together and working on a project together and eating together. And that as something that is really important that people don't necessarily do. And in America, you grab a bacon, egg and cheese on your walk to the subway and you, like, eat it while you're on the subway. And then you sit at your desk typing away in your cubicle, eating a salad from the place downstairs. And then you grab a piece of pizza on your way to do something else, go see a movie or whatever. And, you know, there is value. And I'm not, you know, look, you don't have to do it every day. You don't have to do it multiple times a day. But, like, once in a while, I think you should sit down with people across the table and eat. And if you have prepared that food, there's, like, another level of greatness there.
I totally agree with that. I think it's an interesting... So let's talk a little bit about drinks. I think it's an interesting shift. You know, I was a chef for 12 years. I was in the back of the house. I've been in the front of the house now for 15 years. It would always bother me a little bit, and I didn't really know maybe in the first few times that it happened why it bothered me. But it would always bother me a little bit when a guest would sit there at the bar and I would be serving them food and drinks, and they would grill me on every item on the menu. What farm did this beef come from? Are these eggs, local? Where did you get these greens from? Grill, 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 grill. And by the way, in this scene that I'm painting here, it's wintertime and there's, snow slowly drifting down from the sky, right? And then they grill, grill, grill on all the items.
But your
on the
hair
menu.
Looks awesome.
And then they turn around and they say, I'll have a mojito. And I think to myself, this mint probably traveled all the way from Chile.
Right, right.
It's not local. It's probably not sustainable.
Right. And these limes are not actually in season anywhere.
Ever.
Yeah.
Limes, I think, are something we created.
Yeah.
But people somehow don't make the same connection to their drink as they do to their food. Even though more and more and more, I see all across the board, we have, chef tenders, bartenders who are doing a lot of stuff in the kitchen to make those drinks happen. Hmm. And I still feel like many of those guys and ladies are still breaking that seasonality rule.
Right.
I've said before, I drink like I eat. And there's four pieces to that puzzle. I drink first to the season, second to the occasion, third to the atmosphere, and fourth, every fucking day.
Right.
Right? So that means, I'm not ordering that mojito if there's snow coming down.
Right.
That's the seasonality part.
Yeah.
But as far as atmosphere goes, if I'm at Miss Favela's, the Brazilian bar over in Williamsburg, and they're playing crazy music and we're dancing and they got pitchers of mojito flowing around and there's snow on the ground, I'm ordering that. That's the atmosphere.
Right.
Occasion, I'm not a big champagne drinker. Surprise, surprise. But on New Year's Eve, boy, I knocked down a few bottles.
Yeah.
Right? That's just how it's supposed to be, and that's the same way with food, I think. And people totally understand that with food, yet it's completely abstract when it comes to drinks.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I've been hearing about
it's wintertime. I should eat a bunch of roasted vegetables and a strawberry margarita.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're thinking, you know?
I mean, that gets back to the libertarian in me. That's like, if you want a strawberry margarita, I guess go for it. I
understand
that
drinks are luxury as well. Yeah. And maybe that's a part of that, right?
Right.
The food is a thing that we have to have. So let's make sure it's the localest, most sustainable.
Yeah.
But drinks are luxury. So maybe I want to say, fuck off. I want a lychee martini with lychees that came all the way from who knows where.
In a can for 3 years.
Who knows? Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
So I get kind of both sides, but it's still kind of weirdly bothersome.
Yeah. I mean, someone mentioned to me that, in the craft beer, craft beer is becoming so much more and more popular, but that the one beer is in the market that is continuing to get, that isn't really being affected by that is Mexican beers. And one of the reasons this was anecdotal, but one of the things that they told me is that they felt like it was because the Mexican beers, like when you drink a Pacifico, it's because you want to be on the beach.
Yeah,
and in your brain, you're like, I'm drinking a Pacifico. I could be on the beach.
I don't know why those types of beers got labeled as lawnmower beers. That sounds like work. I want them to be called beach beers.
Yeah.
I don't want a lawnmower beer. I want a beach beer.
Total. I mean, today in New York is a beach beer day.
Yeah, a little bit humid out there, but I love this stuff. So you've brought for us some vinegar to drink.
I did.
And we're talking about beer. And I would like to mention that, I'm from the Deep South. And it has long been a practice in the South, and probably other places in the world, but my personal experience is that it's long been a practice to have a lawnmower-type beer, Budweiser, etc., with some dashes of vinegar in it. And usually that vinegar is sport pepper vinegar, because that's typically on the table when we're eating our greens, collard greens, etc. You dash sport pepper vinegar on them. But it's totally common to a few dashes into your beer and a pinch of salt.
Oh, salt too, huh?
Yeah, just a pinch.
I've seen people put ground pepper in
beers,
but I love putting vinegar in beer.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be. I mean, it's, so the beer, the vinegars that I brought, I'm also a vinegar maker.
Yeah, that's what we're about to talk about.
And so I brought a couple of vinegars that I made. I brought one that I call mishmash malt vinegar because I don't remember what went into it. I had about a half a keg of some homebrew. Someone else gave me some beer that they had in a keg that they had also brewed. And then we had what was left of, I think, some of a keg of Brooklyn Brewery beer as well. I sort of put it all together. That one I then aged in a charred oak barrel that I was given by the folks over at the Shanty.
Fun. From
New York Distilling.
From what was in it?
What was in it was one of their rye experiments.
Yeah.
Cool. And so that one is really interesting because it has this, I mean, it tastes almost, I mean, it's a crazy umami. Like it's got like a soy sauce kind of thing going on.
I really dig that.
And I think part of that was from the wood. And I think part of it was from the fact that, one of the home brews was like almost like really, it was like syrupy, like Belgian, like dark kind of beer. So I think the syrupiness sort of as it got acidified translated into this umami thing.
Red.
Then I have one that was...
Hang on one second.
Yeah, go ahead.
We're going to... It's mid-show, so we always take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. You know, that's how we stay on the air. So we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk about the remainder of these vinegars that are on the table. Probably going to pour ourselves some while we're on the break and start drinking them. And then we're going to talk about what you're getting into now coming up. All right, so stay tuned to the Speakeasy. We'll be right back in just a minute.
Heritage Foods USA is a farm-to-table online butcher and founding sponsor of Heritage Radio Network.
Patrick Martins founded Heritage Foods USA in 2002 to save endangered species of livestock from extinction. He learned about the plight of endangered foods while working for Slow Food, a nonprofit started in 1986 in Italy when the first McDonald's opened on the Spanish steps of Rome. To counter the homogenizing effects of fast food, Slow Food was formed to bring attention to regional cuisines and ingredients.
By 2000, Patrick was the president of Slow Foods USA and working on adding heritage breeds to their arc of taste. But he decided to go further than a metaphorical arc and actually do something to preserve rare breeds.
That was the moment that Heritage Foods slogan, "Eat 'em to save 'em," was born. By creating a market for delicious meats from heritage breeds, we can ensure they'll be around for generations to come.
Plus, heritage breeds just taste a whole lot better. Learn more at heritagefoodsusa.com and use the code HERITAGERADIO for 2 free pork chops with your first order, brother.
And welcome back to the Speakeasy, broadcasting to you live from the future.
The future.
Yeah. In the studio today with Harry Rosenblum. He's a man of many parts, and he's brought a bunch of vinegar with him that he made himself. And then he's going to describe a few more of them. We're going to start drinking them, and then we're going to talk about your book.
Sounds great. Yeah. So before
you talked about the what did you call that one?
The mishmash malt vinegar.
Mishmash malt vinegar.
Yeah.
Which sounds like I want that all over my fish and chips with mushy peas.
Yeah, that one would be great on fish and chips. That one would also be great like just. You could use it the way you use soy sauce. That one is so umami tasting. You should definitely taste it.
Let me see.
Okay.
Probably shouldn't have sat so far across the table from each other.
And then the second vinegar that I brought.
Whoa, this smells amazing.
I know. It's crazy. It's one of the most interesting vinegars I've made. And I've made, you know, dozens and dozens of vinegars.
Wow. I just took about a teaspoonful. So savory.
Yeah.
And bright.
Yeah.
My mouth is watering like crazy, and it really smells like a chip shop.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing. How long did it take you to make this?
So that one took about 6 weeks to ferment the beer into vinegar, and then it aged for about another 6 weeks in the charred oak barrel. Yeah, I mean, the beer started out pretty dark. I don't think that color came so much from the barrel. I think the rye or whatever they made in the barrel first took a lot of the color out of the oak. Yeah. But I got into making malt vinegars because I discovered after making a bunch of vinegar that malt vinegar was very easy to make, especially with darker beers, because there's enough nutrient in the beer for the bacteria to really thrive, and you don't have to water it down like you do with wine. The vinegar bacteria, the Acetobacter, doesn't like things that are above about 9% ABV.
Right, because you'll kill it, right?
Yeah, it gets really slow. It's hard for it to convert, and it just doesn't like that environment.
It likes alcohol. It just likes it light.
Yeah, in moderation.
Yeah, like me and yeah. You. You guys should all drink in moderation.
Exactly. But, you know, the other thing was that there are starting to be on the market, at least in the United States, some very interesting vinegars in the realm of wine vinegars. There's a Lindera Farms makes a huge variety of vinegars down in Virginia. He makes a ramp vinegar and a spice bush vinegar and does a lot of foraged ingredients. The folks at Keepwell Vinegar in Pennsylvania are doing aronia berry vinegars. They're doing grape juice vinegars, lots of great stuff.
Seems pretty endless, your opportunities.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, anything you can turn into alcohol, but there's really not malt being done. I mean, the folks at Keepwell are doing a malt, but I just felt like in that classic sort of malt vinegar style, you know, we have good apple cider vinegar that's available pretty readily, and there's decent wine vinegars, both from Northern California. Katz makes some incredible ones, and then coming out of Europe. But malt vinegar, you know, the stuff we get here is like crappy you know, like, and it's like caramel colored and it's not real malt vinegar. And it just opened my eyes when I started as a home brewer to turn some of my beers into vinegar. I was like, this is amazing because you get the maltiness of the beer, but you then get acid with it as well. So the second one that I brought was made by the beer was called Lupulos con Leche. And it was a hopped ale that had lactose in it for mouthfeel that was made at Rockaway Brewing by my friend Ray Gerard, who mm-hmm. used to work at the Brooklyn Kitchen and now brews at Rockaway. And this one I find to be also really crazy. You can smell and taste the hops in it, and in a way that like you wouldn't. I don't know. You wouldn't really expect, I think, from most malt vinegar, and certainly not from malt vinegar that you can buy.
It smells like a beer.
Yeah. Yeah, it smells like a beer, but then when you taste it, it's acidic. And so, you know, that opens up a whole lot of interesting flavor opportunities, both for mixing into drinks or for cooking as well.
I feel like, okay, we're just going to use the example that we have right in front of us on the table, which is a beer. I've got, you know, my tried and true red and white Dynamite Budweiser in front of me. I feel like if I put a few splashes of this into my beer, I would have a kind of a hoppy sour beer.
Yeah.
Right. This is going to transform my
good
old totally. Budweiser into a Goza.
Yeah, for sure.
And I'm no beer nerd, so I'm probably mispronouncing that. So don't yell at me, people. But that's great. I just took a second dose of it.
Yeah. And if you pour that over, you know, over ice with some seltzer or even just some water, the flavors open up quite a bit. So, you know, one of the real revelatory malt vinegars I made early on is I begged 5 gallons of fresh Brooklyn Brewery summer ale from the folks over at the brewery and turned it into vinegar. And it was amazing because what I discovered is that, you know, that beer has a lot of citrus notes to it, but it has no acid in the beer itself. It's a really, you know, it's a real easy drinking beer. When you turn the alcohol into acid and then you pour it over ice with seltzer, it tastes like you're drinking a lemonade.
Right. This is a great way to have shelf stable acid on hand.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. So then the other ones I brought were an apple cider vinegar that I made by that one was fermented straight through from apple cider. So I took raw apple cider and let it naturally, spontaneously ferment with the yeast that was present. And that created the alcohol and then fermented that into vinegar with the addition of acetobacter.
Awesome. I love apple cider vinegar. It's kind of my favorite fruit vinegar. I'm making an experiment over here. So I just put some Budweiser over ice with the Lupulo con Leche.
Yeah,
so it's the one that smelled hoppy. It's fascinating. It's fascinating.
Try this.
It tastes like a Goza. I mean, you know, needs some balance, needs some tweaking.
Yeah,
but like it reads as a totally different thing with just a few dashes, really.
Right. I mean, because you're not used to that acid.
A little goes a long way.
It does indeed.
So, what got you into vinegar making? And we're gonna talk about your book in a sec, but
yeah.
You're I think just from based on what you talked about in the beginning of the show, you're more at home in the kitchen, but you like to brew.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a tinkerer.
Yeah,
my wife talks,
again
talks
from the list of things you just said.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I've always been a tinkerer. I got into brewing, home brewing in college, because I very quickly figured out that the homebrew store that was next to the package store would sell me all the stuff to make beer, but I wasn't old enough to buy beer.
Fucking genius.
So I made a bunch of really shitty beer when I was like 19.
But I even remember in the heyday of homebrewing, there were even those t-shirts that were every homebrew shop had the t-shirt that said, it's still a homebrew.
Yeah.
Like, it's still beer.
Yeah.
Whatever. If I fucked it up, I'll
exactly.
still drink it.
Still drink
it.
Well,
still a homebrew.
And at age 20, that was definitely true. So I did a bunch of brewing. And then when I moved to Williamsburg 18 years ago, I lived in an apartment that just had a door that opened onto the street and had a mail slot. And I couldn't get packages. And I was freelance. And so I had nowhere to get supplies. And there were no homebrew stores in New York City at the time. There was one way out on the LIE, almost to Queens. Right. I mean, almost to Long Island in Queens that I couldn't get to. I didn't have a car. So I very quickly figured out, you know, if I wanted to keep making stuff and tinkering with alcohol manufacturing, that cider was the way to go. Because I could get packets of champagne yeast delivered in an envelope that would fit through the mail slot. So I would go to the green market, I would buy a couple gallons of apple cider, and I would ferment my own hard cider. And then,
so basically this is just, you know, obstacles being the mother of invention.
You got
it. Just working your way around.
Oh, I mean, totally. So the next part of the story is that one night about, I don't know, 14 years ago, maybe, I was bottling a 5-gallon batch of cider that I had in fact pressed the apples myself and done the whole thing because I was curious. Now that's something that I wouldn't do again, but I was just curious. I was like, I want to know how this works.
Sometimes you got to know by doing it. Like, exactly. You know, I tell people all the time, I love bitters. I don't recommend making them.
Yeah. Right. But you know how they're made. So yeah,
exactly.
You know. So I was bottling this batch of cider and I had miscalculated or misplaced or whatever. I didn't have enough empty bottles. So I had about a gallon of hard cider left that I had started exposing to the air. And so that's the big key here is air, right? So when you're making beer or cider, you want the fermentation to happen in an anaerobic environment. You do not want oxygen. You don't want to oxidize your final beverage product.
Yeah, when you make homebrew, you've got your...
you have an airlock on
there.
You're
in a bucket with an airlock.
Exactly. So the yeast are anaerobic. The yeast are eating the sugar and converting that into alcohol. Then in the presence of oxygen, if you have acetobacter, that bacteria with oxygen, which it needs to survive, like you and me, it will convert that ethyl alcohol into acetic acid. So I had about a gallon of homemade hard cider left, and I didn't know what to do with it. And I remembered that I had a little bottle of organic white wine vinegar in my pantry that had grown this weird little raft on top that people called mother.
Yeah, the vinegar mother.
So I dumped them together, and I left it in the corner of the boiler room for like 2 months. And when I went back, the apple cider vinegar was delicious. And the cider from that batch was like, meh. So. And so I was like, oh, man, this is amazing.
I mean, that's probably the business plan of a lot of folks, right? They go,
sure.
Oh, we got these apples. They're not that great in hard cider, but they're delicious in vinegar. So we're going down that road.
Sure. I mean, my friend Bob Sewell up in Maine is an organic apple farmer and turns most of his product into vinegar in part because he is unwilling to pasteurize his sweet cider. And so he only sells direct on his farm. And he won't pasteurize it in order to be able to wholesale it. And the FDA came down on him about it. And so he now converts almost all of it into vinegar, which it's then shelf stable. And you have a much, you know, you end up having a higher price point product because nobody's buying, I mean, not nobody, but most people are not buying a gallon of vinegar. They're buying little, you know, 8-16 ounce bottles. So.
Right. Huh. Pretty genius, but pretty shitty of the FDA.
Yeah. So that's how I got into...
up everything. Cheese and milk.
Yeah. Sake now. There's a sake brewery that is being told they're not allowed to raise their koji in wood the way it's been done in Japan for like 1,000 years.
Time to move to Japan.
Totally. I'm with you. I'm there. Yeah. So I started making vinegar and started playing with it and experimenting it. And every time I had a little bit of wine left or... you know, some beer, or I would had some cider. Or I would make.
I mean,
some
do you have
cider.
Like all these Crocs around your apartment?
Oh
or?
Yeah. My, I've got like
again going back to the metropolitan nature of where we live. I don't have room in my apartment for anything that isn't absolutely necessary.
So I luckily
I leave my shoes out in the hallway. Yeah. There's no room in here.
I luckily ended up at the time I had access to a boiler room, which had a lot of sort of room around the sides of the boiler and. Vinegar's not flammable, so I figured it was no big deal to like leave a bunch of Crocs and a bunch of bottles in there.
Also kind of nice and warm for them, I guess.
Exactly. The bacteria does like it to be a little bit warm.
Sure.
You know. So, and then my current apartment has a smaller kitchen, but I do have a shelf that's kind of dedicated to these experiments, but luckily I also have the Brooklyn kitchen. So, I mean, I have an entire big laboratory. I got a big space there. And I'm working on bringing to market a brand called, it will be called Revival Vinegar.
And
the goal is for that to be the first product will be a 16-ounce malt vinegar that will be made from Victory Brewing ale, and hoping to get that to market sometime in the fall,
awesome.
Maybe early next year by the time we actually get it together.
That's great. You got some kind of deal with them where they give you spent beer or beer that they can't use? Or
Actually, I'm just going to take beer. So I'm going to be making it at a food manufacturing facility that is in the same complex as their main brewery. Mm-hmm. And we're just going to buy beer from them before it goes in a bottle or a keg. We're going to buy finished beer from them right out of the fermenter and then ferment it into vinegar in this other space because they don't want vinegar anywhere near their brewery.
Of course, yeah.
The first time I brought a bottle of the... vinegar that I made from some Brooklyn Brewery beer. I walked over to the brewery, walked into the brew house and said, hey guys, I brought you this vinegar. And I held up a little 8-ounce bottle and all the brewers looked at me like I was holding a grenade that I had just like released the clip on.
You've
like,
suddenly brought this terribly aggressive thing that could ruin everything we've done.
So I backed out slowly and I said, I'm going to leave it out here, but here's this vinegar. You can don't keep it in the brew house, but you might want to try it. It's delicious.
That's amazing. So right here on the table, I've got an advanced copy of your book. Vinegar Revival. And that's what you just said you're going to call the vinegar, right?
Yeah. So the book is called Vinegar Revival. The vinegar will be called Revival Vinegar Works.
Revival Vinegar Works.
Yeah.
Pretty smart. Pretty smart. Says artisanal recipes for brightening dishes and drinks with homemade vinegars. And then I got to glance through it a lot yesterday. We were on the train together for a couple hours. There's a lot more drinks recipes in here than I expected. Like, I really thought this was going to be, you know, savory, kitchen, all that kind of thing. But you really kick it off with some drinks that are pretty amazing looking.
You know,
and easy.
They are easy. And people ask me all the time, you know, what do I think about drinking vinegars, which have kind of become a thing recently, and people talk about it. And, you know, we talked about this yesterday. A lot of those are just soda syrups. They're, you know, soda's acidic already. In most cases, it's citric acid. So, I mean, a Coca-Cola is the same acidity as those vinegars you tasted.
Right. It's just balanced out with a metric crap ton of sweetener.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I've said a million times, if Coca-Cola were flat, alcoholic, and unsweetened, it'd be the number one selling Amaro in the world.
How do we make that?
It's a bridge to jump over, but think about that.
Yeah.
It's universally popular.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, let's talk about your book some.
Yeah. So the book, the book starts out with basically how to make vinegar at home, which is incredibly easy.
And it is easy because there's a lot of passive time.
It's a ton of passive time. Like, the bacteria do the heavy lifting.
You're not like hanging around and stirring or shaking every day or moving it from light to dark or whatever. But so just as an average, I haven't looked at all the times on these recipes. How long does it take for the reader to make a batch of vinegar?
It will vary. It'll vary a lot depending on environmental factors with your own space, how warm it is, what the humidity is, those kinds of things. But I would say on average, it takes between 4 and 6 weeks for a batch to convert. But that could be as long as 3 months, depending on what you've started with as a base liquid.
Sure.
If you're fermenting all the way from like a sweet cider that has to go through alcohol fermentation and then through acidic fermentation, can take longer.
Now, one of the things that I sort of warn people, as I kind of cheekily did earlier, about making your own bitters is it takes a while and you kind of don't know what the outcome is. And even if it's amazing, I defy you to repeat it. What's the fail rate of making vinegar? Because I don't think it's that high.
No, it's not.
Again, sort of like the homebrew. Even if it's not the greatest, it's still pretty fucking good.
If it's not the greatest, it's not that good. And what I would say that's different about like the world of bitters is that there are, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of delicious bitters that are on the market.
Oh, yeah.
And they're not, in the grand scheme of things, all that expensive.
Right.
Vinegar is a very different product. There are very few. You go to if you go into a supermarket in a metropolitan area, you're going to find Angostura on the shelf.
Sure.
And you might even find some Regans or some Peychauds, depending where you are. Right. If you go into a supermarket in this country and you go to vinegar, you're going to see white distilled. You're going to see red wine vinegar that's probably just colored red. You're going to see white wine, maybe, or champagne. You're going to see super watery balsamic that's probably not very good. And you might see, and you'll probably see some apple cider that will range either from caramel colored stuff that doesn't really taste like apples to you might find some organic raw apple cider vinegar. But that's kind of it. And so one of the things that I think at the moment anyway is that that marketplace doesn't.
This apple cider vinegar, by the way, smells amazing.
Thank you. Doesn't have that much in the market such that if you make it at home, most likely you are going to make something that is delicious and is probably better than what you can buy and much cheaper.
Right. And I think it's always important to note that it'll be much cheaper, but I don't think people give a shit about that.
You're probably right.
I think people give a shit about it. Is it better? And did I make it?
Yeah.
And did I do what you've done right here? You brought me four little adorable bottles that you've, you know, hand labeled that are just charming as fuck. Right. So you make way more than you need.
Yeah, of course.
Because it's the same time, whether you're making an eight-ounce bottle or 2 gallons, right?
Yeah, and if you start with a single bottle of wine, you're going to end up watering that down probably by half, right? So then you're making, you know, accounting for evaporation, you're making like a liter or more of vinegar. You can give some away. You can have some to use. And then, you know, and then you could also go the direction that happens a lot in Europe. Certainly in France, where you have a sort of never-ending vinegar. You just have a crock on the counter, and you pour half a bottle of wine, a quarter bottle of wine, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. You can even add beer, sake, whatever you want that has alcohol in it, into this crock, and then every couple of weeks you draw some off into the bottle you're using to cook with.
Right.
And it's just a never-ending, always-changing acid.
Well, all the folks listening know about the, you know, never-ending bitters, the decanter bitters. all the folks listening know about Solera style, you know, fortified wines, et cetera.
Sure.
Like, it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's a sort of a, you know, a built-in waste not, want not situation.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like your compost pile. You're always adding to it, but yep. It's always going away at the same time. So.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the Solera. I do say in the book, and I often tell people, don't make sherry vinegar at home. You can make vinegar from sherry, but it will not be the same because
right.
unless you're going to invest in a Solera, yeah. which you're not going to.
Unless you're
going to
invest literally a lifetime.
Yeah. And the same thing is true of balsamic. You know, there's
right.
no there's no reason to even try to make balsamic at home. When you consider what goes into that with having to buy the Barrica, with having to store it, with having the time. I mean, you know, you consider they start with 100 liters and 20 years later they end up with 10.
Yeah.
And then they blend that together, and then if the and then the consortium has to taste it,
and give it a pass,
and give it a pass, and say it's good enough,
right?
And in at least in Reggio Emilia, the ages that you see on the bottles, whether that's 18 or 25, it's not actually that the vinegar is not. It's at least that old,
right?
And that's
so
not
similar to cognac.
Yeah, except that is in fact not because they have to certify, but because no vinegar maker in his right mind would submit something that was younger than that and try and get it passed.
Right.
Because it won't.
Exactly. So there's the rub. You go home, you DIY and make your own all manner of vinegars,
yeah.
and then you spend some money on balsamic and the sherry vinegar.
Exactly.
There you go. You saved all that money.
Yeah.
You saved all that money making your own vinegars. How often do you drink the vinegars? How often do you cook with vinegars? Is it
everyday
practice for you?
Every day. I mean, I drink vinegar.
Since that first batch 14 years ago? By your water heater?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I pour some water, some vinegar over water or into water every morning.
Yeah.
Just as sort of my regular, morning beverage next to my espresso.
First thing I do every single morning is drink an Underberg before I brush my teeth or anything. Anyway,
you just have a clot. That's what you have in your oven.
I don't drink
you have
coffee.
Underberg in your oven?
No, that's probably a good place to keep it because I buy it by the case.
Yeah.
Self.
Yeah. There you
hey
go.
Siri, take a note.
Yeah. And then I cook with it all the time. I mean, the other night for dinner, I came home. I didn't know what I was going to make. I just sort of looked at what I had. I had like a zucchini and an onion.
Whoa,
that was loud.
What the hell was that?
I don't know. I don't even know where that was.
All right. Zucchini and onion.
Zucchini and onion. And I had some stew beef sitting there that I, you know, just it was in the freezer and I defrosted it. And I was like, I'm not going to make like a long stew. And so I just did like I sauteed the vegetables. I cooked the beef off, poured off the fat, and then just simmered everything with some vinegar. A little bit of vinegar and a little bit of beer.
Delicious.
Simmered it and it was done. Ate it over rice. Super easy.
Amazing.
And I also, you know, I think that people are, as they learn to cook at home, and I went through this as I learned to cook at home, you end up using salt a lot. I mean, restaurants, there's a shitload of salt in all the food, and you end up adding salt and adding salt and adding salt. And really, what I would encourage everyone who's listening and anyone who buys my book to try is don't add as much salt, add a little bit of acid.
Yeah, no, I kind of agree with that. Lots of cuisines have that, you know, especially Latin cuisines. You're eating your tacos and they always come with a lime wedge on the side.
Yep.
The same is true of some Indian cuisines as well. And I don't think it's a terrible idea at all to have like even just a little atomizer of your
yeah,
favorite vinegar
absolutely.
Nearby that you can just sort of put a sheen on all your food.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a spray bottle for vinegar is incredibly useful, really great for dressing salads and that kind of thing, but also great for, you know, there's a one of my favorite recipes in the book is one of the simplest. I have a recipe in there for just roasted cabbage. You just take red cabbage and you just cut it up into, you know, bite-sized pieces, basically. Toss it with some olive oil, salt. You roast it until it starts to get crispy. And as soon as it comes out of the oven, you spray vinegar on it.
Boom. Sounds delicious.
And that next to a beer is a really good snack.
Bar snack. Okay, so let's do some plugging because we're here at the end of the show. First thing, I think, plug your show.
Sweet. Feast Your Ears every Wednesday at 1 p.m. I interview people in and outside of the food spectrum about what they do, how it influences their personal life, and influences what they eat and what they cook.
Amazing. It's a great show. You've only been on for a short time, right?
Today was episode, I want to say 78.
Oh, you mean last week?
Oh, yeah, last week.
Today will be episode 79.
Today will be episode 79. We're in the future. I forgot. It's very confusing in the future.
I warned you. Time travel is not for everyone. And then let's plug this thing.
So Vinegar Revival, my first book, comes out August 1st. We will be having a...
Potter Publishing.
Yep.
They love it when you say that.
Yeah, Clarkson Potter. We will be having a kickoff sort of book launch party down at our Brooklyn Kitchen Industry City space on August 1st. And if you can't make it down to Industry City, we will be having another event that I will share the stage with another Vinegar book author and also one of our co-hosts here at Heritage Radio, Michael Harlan Turkell.
Oh, right.
And that will be a Heritage Radio event, and that will be actually be on August 9th, the following week, at the Brooklyn Kitchen in Williamsburg.
Right on.
And you can order Vinegar Revival at vinegarrevival.com or on amazon.com or from your local bookstore. If you order it from me at vinegarrevival.com, I will sign it and send you a bottle of vinegar when it comes out.
Nice. Bonus round. Bottle of vinegar comes with the book. That's great. Well, thanks so much for being our guest today on the Speakeasy, our guest in the future on the Speakeasy. While we're down in New Orleans.
Yeah,
I
know you guys are having a great time.
We're having a great time. That's why I seem so drunk.
I don't know how you can be in two places at once.
That's why I seem so drunk right now. So next week on July 26th, we'll have a clip show. Damon and I are taking down some Zoom recorders to New Orleans, and we're going to interview some folks down there. I've set up a few pretty cool ones, and we're just going to clip the show together in the editing studio. I don't know how to do that yet, so you know, it may be great, it may be a fiasco. Either way, tune in next week to hear that. The following week, Misty Kalkofen, who is one of the premier Mezcal authorities in the United States, is going to be on the show immediately following the show. She is going to be on the bar at Coup, making drinks with Vita Mezcal and doing it all for charity. August 9th, we got Karen Fu of the Donna here in New York City. So that's a pretty stalwart lineup of folks coming up to talk to us about drinking and having a great time here on the Speakeasy. But that's it for the show today. Please tune into heritageradionetwork.org to listen to thousands more shows just like this one. If you have the moment, tap on the beating heart on the website and donate so we can keep shows just like this one alive and shows like Harry's going as well. Thanks again, Harry, for being in the studio with us today, and we'll talk to you next time on the Speakeasy. Cheers, guys.
Thanks so much.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that send. It's gonna get you some. That S I N and those things that took you in. To God fearing man, a redeemed one at that. The warning comes from deep within. You're not the loser, so to that rock and roll, to the whiskey and lose a man. It's a devil sound that you spin round and round. Prevent and close your ears to it. So you don't shun. Satan's